Hello again, everyone. TJ Schwartz here. I'm here with Lucas Burnley. This is the Edge and Flow podcast, where we talk about knives, of course, designing and making them, craftsmanship, knife shows, how to build a business, and how not to build a business sometimes.
Sometimes.
How you doing, Lucas?
Man, I'm doing good. Full tank right now.
Yeah, same.
Good. Well, we only missed 1 week this time, which is like, I'm feeling pretty strong about that. I think we should do shop updates. You've been quietly cranking. I'm just coming out of my last show of the year. Do you want to start with what you've got going on?
Sure. Yeah. The LT5 is finally like kind of fully installed into our system, because it needed to become a weekly, we talked about a little bit on the last episode, but it needed to become a weekly installment into our schedule. And it has officially become that. So we're building a certain amount of them every week. And it's worked pretty well in that regard. And we're super happy. So that new formula with the A2 is now sustaining. And so we're going to continue to expand on that and whatnot. But one of the main things is that it has fully bottlenecked our Tormach, because the Tormach runs our sheaths and our scales, and the LT5 being fully 3D machined and being a large scale it just takes quite a bit of time for the machine to crank them out. So I'm beginning the process of migrating the LT5 scales to the Sile, which I don't really look forward to, because we're going to start running them wet with coolant as opposed to dry. In doing so, I have everything ordered to build a DIY paper band auxiliary tank with a paper band filter on it to prevent buildup, essentially. And we're going to see if we can get that to work.
Okay. I gave you my limited experience with wet milling composites again, mm-hmm. in like some significant numbers. And it was pretty shocking. So I'm really curious to, I really wanted it to be better for me than it was. And I'm sure it can't, like, I'm sure there's a way to do it, but I ran into enough like pain points that I feel like solving for dry at this point might be my solution. Mm-hmm. When do you get your new machine?
They are saying August, so that's been the agreement for a few months now. So it's looking like,
so you don't have like an ETA other than a month.
Yeah, they're saying August. Yeah. So okay. Yeah, it's because it's the new. I mean, this is the first wave to come to the U.S., so it's kind of like I almost like pre-ordered one. And so with an X7, it would be totally different, because it's a stable, you know, consistent influx of those coming in.
Right.
So we're still waiting on the X9, which is fine. It's actually, the timing is about perfect, because it gave us some breathing room after the crazy last few months we've had. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'm starting to look forward to it, because what we're looking at, and the reason I'm running the material wet in the Sile, is that I found an issue with using a machine to go dry and wet. It really, I found, needed to be one or the other.
Totally.
And because if you go run flood coolant, the entire machine covers in a film of oil.
Yep.
You run dry, even with a good vacuum, everything just slowly darkens, because the dust sticks to the walls. It sticks to all the surfaces. It sticks to all the tool holders. And you're in there with like a paper towel wiping this just nasty soot off of like the whole thing. And so with the Tormach, we wiped everything with Windex. Like I spent hours like drying and cleaning every surface, and then anything that needed to be, I put a rust preventer on it. But as far as the enclosure and like the tool changer, bone dried, no oil. And then when you run dry, the dust can get vacuumed up, because it doesn't stick to the walls anymore. Right. And so the Sile, if we're going to have scales and tangs on it, we kind of have to run it all wet. And so I do think eventually, if the X9 shows up, and if it's going to do bevel grinding, but if it has the time to also do the perimeter machining, then it will be a wet machine. And then the X7 will probably go back to being dry for scales only.
Oh, interesting.
And so, so it'll like directly replace the Tormach in that.
And then Tormach would stay Kydex.
Kydex. Yeah.
I love that as like a flow, as you're adding equipment, the last piece is kind of shifting down the production line. Yeah,
kind
line.
Of demoted. Yep, exactly.
Yeah, you're like, hey, you're still working really well, but like, we're going to shift you. Like, that yeah. seems like perfect for the Tormach, honestly, where you're like, cool, there's no like spindle load. Like, you don't need a lot of tools. Like, all yeah. of that is a good application.
Mm-hmm.
I'm struggling with one spindle right now.
It's one spindle is extremely difficult, I found. It,
yeah. Well, it's just this idea of like, as soon as there's some level of efficiency, you just start to see the bottlenecks.
It's just instant like bottleneck. Yeah.
Making one thing, you can do it the most inefficient way possible. 10 things still. And then it's like, as that number scales, you just start to see like minutes matter, like seconds matter at a point, but like minutes, you're like, whoa, it really adds up. Cleaning time, like everything that's related in this little ecosystem also scales, and it is shocking.
Yeah. Yeah, with the Tormach this week, it's just become apparent because we have these numbers we're trying to hit on the LT5, and you can calculate exactly how many hours are going to be required to do those scales.
Right.
And so it's like, we know at what point in the week, like if we're not starting on LT5s at this time, it's not going to be done because you can't make the machine hurry. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
There's either enough time or there isn't. And so this week we knew that the last scale for this batch was going to come off in the last 30 minutes of Thursday of the last day.
Oh, wow.
And so we're like, we can't turn it off for lunch. We can't stop this machine. So it's like we staggered our lunches so that there's always someone to make sure that that thing kept running. Because if we missed one cycle, it's like the batch is incomplete, which obviously is kind of arbitrary.
Sure.
But it's like we're min-maxing that Tormach. It is a 40-hour machine right now. And the Sile runs one day a week. So that's we're like totally lopsided. Just because everything that is bottlenecked is dry. You know what I mean? And that's like a problem. That's a sticking point right there because we need the Sile to be able to run some of these dry processes. So
it's interesting because with some of this too, and this might be like my hand making side or just like in way that my brain works, but like, you're like, oh, the like for scales or something like that, you're like, tolerances are less, like tools less. It's but the time, so you're bottlenecking because of that, where it's like, oh, maybe that's actually where like the way more efficient machine actually belongs. Or yeah. You're like, yep, no, we need way faster rapids, we need higher spindle speed. Like, it's counterintuitive, at least to my brain, but yeah. It makes sense from like a production standpoint.
Yeah. And I'm going to say this right now, Dalton and I were talking about it. The Tormach is super accurate. Like it's actually, I mean, I kind of just forget about it, but like the way the LT5 scales are set up requires quite a bit of accuracy because we're trying to have them match the tang exactly. Dude, it hits it every time. It's perfect.
Yeah.
It's super accurate. It's just slow. It's really the only drawback to the Tormach. I'll take that back. It doesn't have enough rigidity to do a lot of the stuff we want to do in steel. But when it comes to like the scales, I don't see the Sile doing any better job on the scales. It's going to be pretty much the same result.
Right.
It's just going to do it faster. And so,
that's like proper application for the equipment, right? That, I don't know, like I still get like little machine shop and all of these things where it's, you're like, yeah, you can get a TAG micro mill and you could cut anything on it. It's just how fast are you going to cut it and with what tools. So if it lacks rigidity to do like the bigger jobs, it's just doesn't mean it's not a good machine. It just means it's not a good machine for that.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, yeah. You and I have been looking at routers for that same reason. And like, I'm at the point where like looking at a router versus looking at like a small mill, like a Tormach, I'm like, I haven't been able to make an argument to like switch to router. It's like, by the time you add like an automatic tool changer, it starts to push into mill territory. And I'm like, I feel like I would almost just rather get like a, you know, a 10-year-old Haas mini mill and never run coolant in it. And that's just my dry milling machine because it's cheaper than a router and it's a Haas.
Yeah. The tool changes really get you into trouble on the routers because it requires a certain type of spindle. And then you can't auto tool change on just like a collet chuck router. You know what I mean? It's got to have a taper of some kind. And it really inflates the price when you try to tool change. And I've found with scales that you have to tool change. You can't. Our scales, there's no
I wonder with scales if there's like a custom tooling workaround where like, okay, so you need a ball. You need to be able to interpolate, you know, hardware holes, and you need to be able to cut a profile. It's like, can you just do all that with the same tool or like a stepped tool? Or it's like a version to where it's like, if it's just scales, is there actually like, oh, I got a $5,000 CNC router. I run this one bit. This one bit is able to do all of the features on a set of scales.
I mean, if you had a long enough ball that's small enough diameter, it's conceivably possible.
Yeah. Just but, something, I don't know, something to think about.
Yeah.
It's all the workaround. It's like when you have the, like, every tool is a hammer kind of concept where you're like, if it's what you have, there's probably a way to figure it out.
Yeah.
To maximize the efficiency.
No doubt.
I know the LT5 has gotten some traction. Like, if people want to, like, learn about it, like, that is hitting some, like, YouTube traction.
Yeah, so I've been really happy with how it's been received, because I've said before, I needed to cast a new net in terms of, this is a more bushcraft survival knife, and none of our other stuff is in that category. So I needed to see what people thought about it when it went onto the YouTube airwaves. And so just recently, Gideon's Tactical, who helped modify the design, he was handling prototypes before production.
So
I credit him on the website with like helping with certain decisions on the knife, which is awesome. But he did a YouTube video on it. That's Gideon's Tactical channel. And then there's a few others. Last Huntsman Outdoors, actually the first one, but just a few of the bushcraft channels on YouTube have been using it. And I was really curious, because to me it feels almost like starting a new business. Because like,
totally,
I started with the Overland, and I remember the feeling of like, what are people going to think? You know, with the Magnica, how's it going to go? People liked it, but then when I launched the Overland Sport, I know the steel and the heat treat. I know like the geometry and the edge. Like, I know who I'm selling to. And it's just an addition. Whereas the LT5 is like, this is a different scene, right? I'm entering a room that I don't know anybody and they don't know me. How is this going to go? And I'm really happy with how it's going. I'm really happy with the A2. I'm really happy with it. Nice. So
it's interesting. That is not, it's not a thought that I've really had. And I just think it's because of like the way that I came up through the industry, which is like the fact that there are actually subset different markets, like past like fixed and folder, but I just make what I make.
Mm-hmm.
Right. As I'm starting to shift a little bit and trying to like do some, you know, some in-house models with it where I could like maybe achieve some numbers, I suppose it's starting to come into play a little bit, but it's not as clearly defined as like what you're doing. And I think that is, it's pretty cool that you can almost like, you just like target a section of the market.
Mm-hmm.
Be a fun game to like build out what those sections truly are, or like a thought exercise. Like, even if you think about like tactical as a catch-all, right? It's like inside of the tactical market, what sub genres are there, and like how do you attach to those?
Yeah. Sit down and draw out like a Venn bubble diagram of it'd be interesting.
I actually think that the Overland, if you were to like put a Venn diagram, I think that one, it rides some middle lines like very, very well, which is kind of cool, because I think it actually slips into the tactical market just on like a design language standpoint and construction, but then intentionality, like it shifts off into like outdoor market, the Overland market, like the functionality pushes it in another direction where like someone looking at it could understand it easily as one of two things, like based on their filter.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. LT5 running. What else?
Loving our air conditioning. I got to say, this shop, I had my little tiny one car garage shop. This shop is way more thermally stable than my little one car garage.
Your machines don't heat it up.
No, they don't heat it up. And the air conditioner in here, dude, is I suspect it's for a much bigger building, because it will freeze us cold. I mean, it's been almost 110 degrees. It'll be 110 black asphalt on the other side of a garage door into this shop. And you walk out, it's easily like 115 standing on that blacktop. You come inside, spend a couple hours, and it's literally Dalton and I both are like, I got to put a jacket on. It's like,
dude, I don't know like who needs to hear this, but like if you're have a shop and you're like, man, it's super hot. Nah, I don't need an AC. Like I can do this. This is like, there's some stuff that's like efficiency. So like, I'm gonna be your hype man. Like, get an AC, have a heated shop, have a cooled shop. It makes you more efficient. It makes your work better. If you're comfortable and you can like exist in the space, like you get more done. I don't know what this like fascination with like doing things like the hardest, most uncomfortable, inefficient ways. Like, I'm all for being uncomfortable when I need to be, or in areas that I see a lot of value. Me working over a long time horizon, no. Ergonomics, like your space, you know, it's like, look at Jens Enso. He like takes it to the point where he's like, I want it visually pleasing because I have to be in here. Dude, climate control your shop.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes. It's funny because it's just one duct that blows all that cold air. And if I'm sharpening or if Dalton's on the sandblaster, that's like right where it's aiming. So we need to baffle it and change the direction, because I noticed Dalton like would hang his hoodie on the sandblaster, and he would like walk over to sandblast and like put his hoodie on and then start blasting and then take it off, because it's like right there. It's like an Arctic wind just hitting.
Dalton's a pretty slender dude too. So he doesn't have the thermal mass to like stay warm.
Yeah. Yeah. It's I'm super happy with that. Cause I mean, we moved into the building and I'm like, I don't know how summer's going to go in such a big metal building. We'll see. And I guess pitching for the AC unit we have. I don't know what it is, but it works.
Yeah, dude. Again, all this stuff, like that's an efficiency that really, really is just being comfortable in your space.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Hang on.
Your turn. What's your shop update?
Okay. Shop updates right now. So we just got back from PNWCI, which is the Pacific Northwest Custom Invitational. It's a show put on by Billy Cho and Nick Rolfe in Seaside, Oregon. Man, I could probably just run on this show for a while.
Okay.
It's awesome. If you don't know Billy, Billy is a knife maker and a gunsmith. He has Ironborn Armory. And like one of the things that Billy does is build super, super awesome AK platform rifles. Like one MOA AKs. He's very good. Nick Rolfe is an amazing musician and he's been in the knife industry for a long time. Like they make a really good team. I think the show is definitely like a passion project, and it was kind of one of these things where like every year they're like, well, we did it and that was awesome. Don't know if we'll do it again. I have the sense that at this point it's starting to like stabilize. Man. And it's awesome. So this is the first show that my littlest boy Winston has been to, and this is the first show that Bo's been to since he was a baby. Very family friendly because you're in Seaside. There's a lot to do. There's the ocean. It's also just the vibe. It's not a trade show. It's like a small get together. The roster of knife makers is pretty heavy hitting. And a lot of that is like a testament to relationships, right? Because the first one, it's a 4-hour show, but a lot of people knew Billy and Nick. So their friends came, and their friends just happened to be high level knife makers. And that from that point forward, it's just kind of gotten better and better and better every year. It was really awesome. It was amazing having my family back, or having my family at the show. It was amazing having Maddie back at a show with me. Audience, like crowd was great. I'm trying to think of like high points. We did a side event that was really fun. Shows right now, man, like we can dive into this more too, but like, I need to keep shows exciting for myself somehow. Like I have to have something that's like really interesting. This year we decided to do an event that we called B-Side. And basically what that looked like was renting a small booth inside of an antique mall, about four blocks from the show venue as a pop-up vintage shop for our brand. We had product made specifically for that show. We had like modified apparel. We had like actual vintage apparel that we modified, just like trying to kind of do like, I don't know, like a brand, I don't know if like introspective is the right word. Like one of the things, like for instance, we always have the show banner with us at shows. It's like our Burnley Rose. It's kind of like a big shield. We sold that. And that has been with us at shows for, I don't know, 6 years or something like that. Mm. Probably maybe even more than that. Right. So a collector got to buy that piece. And I love that idea that you're able to like kind of get these pieces that have like some historical relevance or like, mm-hmm. you know what it is, but not a lot of other people do. It also, the show is one day. And I realize like a lot of people come into town for the weekend. And I just thought it would be fun to like create an event, an activity.
Mm-hmm.
And the indoor flea market is super cool. And I loved the idea that like, we could set this thing up. They would be able to pull a percentage of our sales, which like helps local economy, which is rad. Not that they necessarily need it, but I like the idea.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a way for me to be able to hit some of like the ideas and exciting projects I want, and also not like have a table that is like insanely cluttered. Cause there's no, I mean, we filled out like a 10-foot booth. And at the show, I had a 6-foot table.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. And so it was just kind of this way of like extending, you know, the show weekend.
I got to say, dude, that's Burnley at its best, at your best. That is like,
<Thank you.
laughs> that is the most Burnley thing I've ever heard to do a pop up like that. That's, I mean, that's what's made you and your brand what they are, is doing stuff like that. That's stuff that nobody else would think about, to be honest. That's cool.
Thanks, man. It was, I got really nice feedback on it. People seem to have a good time. And like, we had a range. I like to do silly stuff. I don't always want to be super serious. And like, doing shows is stressful for me, right? It's a perfect storm. And doing right now, like doing two shows in the summer, back to back, what I consider like kind of high level work, with my kids the ages they are, like, dude, it was hard. Like, there's no way around it. Like, I've worked 7 days a week through, I don't know, since like March or April. Not how I want to do it. This gave this last little push like some real incentive that was, mm-hmm. like, it felt good. The feedback we got was good, but it allowed me to do, so like, we did beach towels.
Nice.
Like, I'm not going to always run beach towels, but if I do a show at a beach,
it's seaside, yeah,
and we do it in an indoor flea market, like the idea of like the part of like the concept was actually to have it feel like in situ the rest of the indoor flea market. Right. So, which is why we did like the vintage apparel.
I got to ask the owner of that flea market, like, what were their feelings on all this? Cause I bet they were kind of taken back. Like, this is
so
interesting.
She was super, super cool. Maddie actually kind of spearheaded it, which if it wasn't for Maddie and Joey, this wouldn't have happened. Right. I was able to put together a lot of the conceptual stuff and the product.
Excuse me.
Bless you. But they did the booth setup. Like, when we got to Seaside, like, I was done.
Mm-hmm.
Like, work was done. Pieces were made. They went and set up the booth from an aesthetic standpoint and like a functional standpoint. And it was amazing. Cause like, I think that ability to like have a little bit of delegation, but also like, if me and Maddie had done it, I think we would have probably just argued about where things went. And I realized, I'm like, you know what you want this booth to look like, whatever. Okay.
Yeah.
So, but I just lost my train of thought completely. Yeah, fully thinking about like that I couldn't have done it on my
delegation.
You were asking about the owner of the booth. So Maddie set up like the original interactions and everything. What was, I think one of the things that was really nice, one of our collectors was like, hey, I've been to that. I went there last year, and we come to Seaside like a couple times a year, and we always stop into this antique mall. She's like, they put it on for you. Like, they had this older, like, old biker dude, Steve, who actually, we didn't realize this, but he like hung out in the booth the whole weekend. He's a vendor in the flea market, but I think they were like, oh, it's knives. Like, there's a bunch of knives and stuff. So he's going to walk those up to the counter. Mm-hmm. Right. We stopped and talked to them for a while, and it seemed like he's just having a blast. That's because awesome. All these people are coming in. They're super excited, kind of like nerding out over what's there. He's like, you know, extrovert, like having a fun time talking. So I think that the overall like experience for the shop was good. Our collectors are like super respectful and nice, and like spent money in the like antique mall anyway, like bought other things. So I think it was good. I think if we want to do it again, we definitely could. And I think if the show venue doesn't change, there's a pretty good chance that we would.
Sweet.
I don't think it's necessarily something that I would carry to another show, because now it feels like this could be an event for like this.
Mm-hmm.
On the flip side, this is a prime example of like ADHD, because it added a huge level of complexity to our show and the months leading up to it. I am getting more okay with that, like just being part of the process.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But it, like, when you're in it, you're like, why am I doing this? This is crazy. You don't even know if it's going to be successful, but it's cool. In my brain, I'm like, all right, we're going to do this.
Well, that's what I mean. It's very Burnley. It's like very, the spontaneousness of the Burnley image is like, that's right on the money for a brand.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's a hard task for you to like maintain that, but at the same time, that's Burnley. You know what I mean? Like it comes with the territory.
I felt pretty good. So like we made it through the show, spent a couple days on the coast, took Bo surfing, ocean surfing for the first time, which was like a high point for me, and he loved it. And it's like one more thing that we can do side by side together now. So yeah, that was a long diatribe on just the show. I do have shop updates, but I kind of want to roll into this is my show done for the year. Okay. From here on out, I feel like it's all shop updates. I'm super excited to like dive into all of these projects that I've kind of had simmering. You have one more show for the year?
Two. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, because you have Blade West.
So we have our booth assignment for Blade West that came through. They moved to a bigger room. This is in October. It's like the very first weekend of October, like the 3rd or something. But we got a booth space in the Salt Palace for Blade Show West in a new, bigger room, which I'm super excited. Blade West is amazing. I love Blade Show West. Like, I love
that
show.
I said, you and I went to the first one in Salt Lake, right?
Yep.
That is a perfect location.
We exhibited there last year. I loved it. It went great. It was great in every way. We can drive it down. Yeah, it's awesome. But another show is the Makers Syndicate, which is in September. So this is going to be like September. I want to say it's like middle of September. I forget exactly the date. But the Makers Syndicate's in Indianapolis. It's hosted by Daniel at Oz Machine Company. And so they're another knife maker / knife company that decided to host their own show.
Yep.
Super interesting premise. Super excited about this show. It's a fledgling show, but they scaled it up a lot this year because
couple years running, or was last year the first?
I want to say this is the third year, but don't quote me. It might be the second. It's probably the third though. And so the way they've targeted it is like they wanted to find like wedding venues in like old industrial type settings.
Sick.
So it's sort of like your old, like an old steel mill with like the big tall windows and the brick and like beams. They went from a smaller one last year to a bigger one this year.
Mm-hmm.
And so just imagine like hardwood floor wedding venue type deal in a city. And it's the interesting twist on this show that I think is unique is that they call it the Maker Syndicate because the only products that can be sold at the show are products that that person made or that person and their team made.
Right.
And so it's like, if you're a company that has some OEM and some in-house, you're only allowed to bring the in-house stuff. So it doesn't matter.
So where do they draw? This is an interesting one. One, I love that you're doing this show. Okay. Because in general, I would say that this is like, it's a 1 day show.
Like, right? Another 5 hour type deal. Just
it's like a 5 hour type deal. Yeah. I think I'm a big fan of kind of like crossing over. Like, our brand is more suited in general to a 5 hour show when I'm doing custom work. That doesn't mean that Blade Show Atlanta is also not a good thing for me to be at. The reverse is true for you, where it's like Blade Show Atlanta might actually, or Blade Show West might be like kind of your bread and butter. But I think that doing these smaller shows gives you a different access to an audience. It might push you to do a few pieces that are like different. Mm-hmm. Think about a show differently. I think there's a huge amount of value.
Yeah.
Where does this show draw the line from? So is it OEM? So it's not outsourced process. They're not dictating that. They're just saying it, whatever your process is to make a part, it has to be that.
Yeah. It just
has to be accurate.
Like, it's like, it, I mean, it explicitly says in the email, I don't have it pulled up right now, but it explicitly says, like, we understand that pretty much everybody outsources something. Like, okay. I outsource Heatree. Yeah. It's not like, it's not a sole authorship thing. Like you'll see in like the ABS,
right?
It's not that extreme. It's just, can you say that you made that product? You know what
right.
I mean?
But and they're actually allowed. And this is partially like what Oz's roots are, right? Like, as a manufacturer, they're allowing that concept. It's not broken down by, like, you know, right now you've kind of heard me rail on like the idea of like machine assisted customs, because it's so nebulous right now. I think like the industry is looking for ways to like categorize and like understand things, but like there's a lot of misunderstanding in that. Mm-hmm. What I love about this show is that it's a higher end kind of exclusive show. Is it an invitational?
Yeah.
Okay. So it's an invitational, but their criteria is like pretty broad and what I would consider like more contemporary. And I think that's very, very cool.
Yeah. And I think part of the concept behind the idea was that, I think they stated this in the email, was that at pretty much every knife show, you kind of have to ask about the products from a standpoint of like, oh, who made this? You know what I mean? And that's like a valid question, not knocking that at all. I'm just saying that's like a normal conversation to have. Whereas at this show, the concept is like, you don't have to ask. If it's in the room, you don't have to
ask. It was made by that person in their shop with them or their team. And it runs the gamut from, you know, single maker in a shop to a small team. Yeah. That, like we talked about after Atlanta, like the rise of like OEM knife brands. There's so many right now because the OEM options are like very good.
Yeah.
Right. Very accessible. Whereas 10, 15 years ago, you really couldn't do it in the same way. Mm-hmm. You basically had to have connections that would put you in with a manufacturer in Asia. So that's a pretty, that's like an interesting take on that. I like it a lot, man. That's very cool.
Yeah. I'm excited. And the reason it kind of happened is Daniel came up to my booth in Atlanta. We had a good conversation going. We hung out in the pit for a while. We're talking and it was fun because we're just talking about steel. We're talking about manufacturing. And he's like, you should come to the show. And I was, you know, I'd heard of it, but it wasn't even on my radar really.
Yeah.
So he just in person, like, invited me in the pit and I was like, yeah, I'll be there. And the nice thing is that it's in and out. You know what I mean? It's like, it's in Indianapolis. That's a ways away, but I can just go. I can bring a rifle case on the airplane.
Yep.
I can set it on a table. I can pack it back up. I can leave. You know what I mean? Yep. It's a very, very low commitment level from a like logistics standpoint.
Yeah.
Which I'm super excited about. So it's going to be fun.
It's pretty amazing. Like the last few years shows have been really tricky, multiple levels, but this year I think it really seeded again, like what the value of doing shows is. And like, everybody's heard me say this, like, it's not about sales, it's about community. Mm-hmm. But the sales play, and getting ready for a show, having that influx of cash a couple times a year, like, it does help the line. Even if there's an expense to it, it's like, you can't, you can't recreate selling a knife face to face online. You just can't. You can't, because you have a conversation. The interactions are different. You sit in the pit and talk to people, or like, you know, the PNWCI, awesome, they have a big beach bonfire afterwards. You know, I was out there till 2 o'clock in the morning, like, just talking with people.
Yeah,
dude.
Yeah.
There is intangible. There's like intangible value to that. Is that even the right word? Kind of
intangible. Yeah.
Intangible. Yeah. There's like an intangible quality to it, where like, who knows what that does, how it affects your business, but I guarantee over the long run it does.
Yeah. Oh, 100%. And with the Maker Syndicate, they do have a social, I can't remember if it's like a dinner, I don't remember, but there's like, I think it's after the show. It's like everyone kind of congregates in a specific place, and it's just like it's part of social addition to the show itself. Yeah. You know what I mean?
It's so fun watching the adaptations, and like, networking is a prime example. Like, I've never met him, right? He didn't come to my table. You are doing a similar type of work, a similar type of process. You're in that sphere.
Mm-hmm.
He made the effort to come and stop by your table. Mm-hmm. And this is like, so like, I would say Billy Cho is the same for me, or a lot of shows up until this point. And I love that it is actually starting. Like, there are new things happening.
Yeah. Yeah.
Shows for me, it shows health in the industry in different ways. Actually, that actually, I think, is a great segue into something that you and I are kind of seeing simultaneously, which is conversations happening around business both being at its best and at its like worst in the knife industry right now.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe why some of that is happening. Does that feel the show, like a show as an analogy for that?
Yeah.
Feels accurate.
Yeah. Another way to put it is like, there feels like there's a little bit of a feast and famine at the same time.
Yeah.
In the knife industry.
Right.
Right now there's a feast and a famine happening, which is,
you're hearing both.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like stratifying in a weird way that I don't recall this being quite like that. I don't know. It's interesting.
So what is that? What do you think?
I mean, the only explanation I can think about is like, there's some sort of migration happening. You know what I mean? It's like there's new opportunities, and then there's models and situations that are no longer as viable, and it happened relatively quickly. You know what I mean? And it's like, I'm still trying to put my finger on exactly what's going on. You know what I mean? It's just such a weird situation. But yeah, I do feel for, I mean, I'm just gonna be flat out honest. Like, I do feel for, there are some brands out there that are having a hard time in the knife industry.
Right.
And I don't like to hear that. You know what I mean? But it's like, but there's other brands that are doing better than ever. And it's super strange to me.
Well, where's the disconnect? You know, it's like your thing on kind of cycles also, like I always use a fashion analogy, because they say it like travels and it's like a 15-year cycle.
Mm-hmm.
I would really like to stop using that. And I would love to be able to use the knife industry as an example. I don't know the data.
Mm-hmm.
I only know like how it feels in my brand, how it feels like in some of my friends' brands, where like when things come back around, or like an interest comes back around. The part of the way that this conversation came was, I think you had said, you're like, we had like a great month. This is awesome. I feel like fixed blades are having like this resurgence. Right. And I pushed back on that a little bit, in that when I see you having a great month, I think it's because, and it could be, you could be totally right, it could be wrong, but I feel like it's the work and the interest and like the way that you're showing up can't help but lead to that, like things being more successful. Right.
Yeah.
Like, dude, you're doing great work. You're being active on social media. You're showing the work. You're doing shows. You're like releasing new products, but like also engaging the community with those products, and you're building network. So if not, if that doesn't lead to things being more successful, like what does? Right. Yeah, that to me is like, that to me is like big root, big tree roots, because you're building things in a stable. That's like how you actually build a stable platform and demand for product.
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah. Right? I appreciate that.
So on the flip side of that, why is there an industry slump? Is it a glut of a certain type of product? Is it that brands are kind of like not like resting on their laurels, but just kind of like, we did have some big boom years. We're not in the big boom years. Not everything is selling just because it exists in, you know, cyberspace.
Yeah.
So is that why there's this disc, like this, I don't know, feast or famine?
Yeah. I mean, if there is, I don't know. I mean, nobody knows the data, but if there is like a shrinkage that happened in the last couple of years after the kind of outdoor knife COVID boom and everybody, you know, with their extra money to spend during that time, like if there is a shrinkage since then, I mean, it's got to be felt somewhere, but I can't say that I know exactly why it's affecting sectors and not others. You know what I mean? It's like a not symmetrical shrinkage, it feels like to me. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it can just be say not correlative at all.
The elephant in the room is like the most spectacular knife company probably ever founded in history, as far as like meteoric rise is happening right now. Montana Knife Company. Like they've no knife company has ever grown that fast ever. There's no way. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's like that's happening right now. So you can't, you know what I mean? So it's like, at the same time, there's a slump happening, but the fastest growing knife company in history also
and doing
exists.
It with things that like people say can't be done.
Yeah.
Which is like fixed blades that are fairly expensive. So
yeah,
it's the process.
Yeah.
The process is the product. Right.
Yeah.
But I mean, seriously, like this is something that spans, I think, the aisle from custom to production. Right. And inside of like the custom market, and in, I don't know, like people in general, like you always hear the phrase like, you know, comparison is the thief of joy. Run your own race. I think there's a lot of value in those concepts. However, if you are a business and if you are a craftsperson, I actually think there's a huge amount of value in being able to like model. To be able to look at a maker or a brand and be like, wow, they are doing what I would like to be doing, or what they're doing is very impressive. What practices can I include in my process to like achieve some of that? Mm-hmm. That to me, I mean, like in business modeling is like a huge thing. That's a good, it's figuring it out, right? It's not about comparison. It's not about like wanting what someone else has. It's about, I think, accepting that you don't have all the answers and that someone further along in the process may have figured some things out that could be helpful. I remember like really early on looking at Ernest Emerson and thinking like, man, that's really, really cool. Like, he was a custom maker. He now has this knife company. How did he get there? And then you like look back and you're like, oh, here's when he did like an overseas OEM project. But this is like free, right? This is when that was not a common thing. You're like injection molded scales. I think it was like the Raven or something. And you're like, oh man. Okay. So he did that maybe before there was like his own in-house production. Maybe that was like an influx of cash that let him like step up the next level.
Yeah.
Some of this stuff right now, I feel like people are almost stubbornly staying in their own like zone of influence and like skill set. And like, I don't know, it's like really dogmatic and strange.
Yeah. Yeah.
So things are changing. You can adapt or not.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, it's definitely changing. I got to say right? that. And it, I don't, it's never changed this fast that I can perceivably in the time that I've been around.
Dude, it is changing. The social media thing is crazy. Like right now, it really is. It is seeming to ramp up. I've got multiple blocked posts that can't be recommended. I just saw that Sam Raven the Pirate, he's got posts that are blocked, and he's, I mean, he's just basically shooting like beautiful content.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And showing a knife.
Nothing inflammatory at all.
We're just getting constantly flagged. This is a real problem.
Mm-hmm.
This is another area where you want to have that, like the strong base.
Yeah.
Right. Ben Peterson, our good friend from NAFS, always talks about like owning the land that you're on.
Yeah.
You know, he has a background that allows him to really understand SEO. I don't do that, but I have a mailing list, right? Your mailing list is gold. Like you, that you're closer to owning that. Like if I had a physical mailing list, like now's the time to send out postcards.
Yeah.
Like,
all right.
It's, I think, so you've talked about this a lot as it, when we were doing CAD, and I think maybe you talk about it in your CAD course. Do you actually talk about your CAD course? The idea of, or the concept around building robust models.
100%.
Okay. 100%. So for you, as it relates to CAD, how do you quantify a robust model?
So a robust model in a CAD model scenario, and which we're going to use as a metaphor, I think, is a model that that gives you the deliverable that you want at the end of it, which is like the file to then program off of or to send to injection molding. But more importantly than that, the ability to adjust critical features without a collapse of the model. You know what I mean? And so a lot of people end up in a CAD situation with a deliverable model that is exactly what they're looking for.
Right.
But it lacks the adjustability.
Yeah. The flexibility
that you can do on the fly and the flexibility. And the problem with that is that it very much deters refinement.
Yeah.
Because if you get to the end of this journey of CAD modeling something and you get a result and it's a deliverable, but you notice there's an ergonomic issue. There's a something is not 100%, but you know that like if I change that feature, it's going to collapse this whole model. So I'm just going to live with it. And I think a lot of people that know CAD know that feeling of like, oh my gosh, I made that decision so early on and I boxed myself in. And to be honest, like it's 90% done. So like, I'm just going to live with it. But if you have a robust model that like, oh, I'm going to change that by 5 degrees or whatever, and it's not going to implode the model, so I can 3D print it again or whatever, that deterrent factor allows for like a further refinement than just in factoring in human nature. Like if it's easy to do, you're going to chase it further. You're going to do it more.
Yielding a better product.
Yielding a better result. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so if you can modify it quickly, efficiently, and it's not as rigid and it's not fragile, then even though the deliverable may end up being identical, you can get there in a much more efficient, less deterrent way. And so I think what you're getting at is the metaphor is like the business model being operated in that such a way.
Yes.
That when the sands of the industry, where's the money flowing? Where are the eyeballs? Yep. When that happens, do you have levers to pull that can change your course that don't break you in the process?
Right. Yeah. The goal is to bend, not break.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, and in you, I talked to you a little bit about the class that you did in Atlanta, and a lot of the takeaways there and like the concept of like running, kind of like you could explain it better than I do, but like the thought exercise of like looking at your capabilities, capacities, network, I think is really relevant in this. So the idea would be like, if you are a sole source business, how do you create flexibility and resiliency around that? So if you're an OEM and you're dependent on one manufacturer, if something happens to that manufacturer, you have no product, right? Is there another product that you can add from a different manufacturer? Ideally, a manufacturer in a different sector.
Yeah.
At a different price point.
And right? Also, if you are using an OEM model, OEM adds a lot of time frame. You know what I mean? We all know this. Yep. Like, there's the prototyping phase, there's a production phase. You have to deal with scheduling.
Yeah.
Is there something you can add to your business that allows a sharper pivot?
Yes.
In other words, maybe it's not a knife. Maybe it's something that you can still have OEM'd, but the cycle is so much shorter that it gives you like that steerage that allows you to change direction faster.
Yep.
And so if you're stuck in a situation where you have a multi-year plan that's rigid, that's exactly what we're talking about. Is like, you can't steer it.
Right.
Yeah. So maybe you're going the right direction now, but what happens when you something send changes?
It, but then there's a crash or a tariff or a, you know, and the same goes for being someone who's making everything 100% by hand, right? On the opposite end of the spectrum. What happens if you hurt yourself?
Mm.
Like, what is the thing that brings in revenue, right? Where is the fail safe, right? Like, where's the redundancy?
And we recently had a revelation occur in our shop that I think is right along these lines. And that is part of how we're selling our knives. So up to just recently, all of our knives were custom ordered.
Right.
All of them. So it was like
every single piece someone spec'd it out.
So there's always like this little lead time and the order stack just grows and shrinks. And we just work on the lowest hanging fruit, which is like the oldest orders. And we're just trying not to let a list get big and then also not wanting it to get too small either. And that's fine. But the only problem with that is I found you subconsciously pace your work in the shop with the order flow, which is good if that's you're just going to do that forever. It's like, okay, orders are a little slower and their list is shrinking. You innately like slow down a little bit. And then when the list starts to grow, you start going faster. And it's like you kind of innately just track with it. You know what I mean? It's kind of like the old adage that like work will expand to the space that you give it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's like, that's fine. But it's like, why is it that when times are really good and it's Q4, we're able to keep up. And then in the summer, once times are slower, we're still keeping up in the same way, but we're making less. Like it's, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so what we're starting to do is adding in stock as a layer on top. And I'm controlling the numbers of in stock that we are planning to produce to basically top off. So it's like if sales on the custom side are near our maximum, in stock is going to be minimum. And I'm planning it within a week. So it's like the very next week, we haven't even started on the in stocks. And then once we know that week, kind of the volume, we can scale and add and subtract.
Dude, I love that because you're being careful to not overextend yourself just to chase like a little bit of extra sales or like an arbitrary number. Mm-hmm. You're actually looking at me like, this is what we're capable of producing. Sometimes we will sell through all of that in this model.
Mm-hmm.
If we don't, we have the capacity to offer it in this model.
Yeah. Yep.
Super, super clean way to do it.
We've only been doing it for like 2 or 3 weeks now, but I just noticed how we had it basically amounts to having extra work to do. We got more to do now. We got a fuller schedule, but the work still is getting done.
Right.
Because it's like, we knew we could do it. Like we've done this before when the orders are like really piling on and we really got to turn up the heat. Like, what if there was a way, it's not artificial, but like a way to manage that like hands-on. Like I said, I can pull levers that make sure that our output is matching the demand as closely as possible. And if you're just waiting for custom orders, I always felt like I can't control that. I don't know. What do I do about that?
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
So that's where we're at, and it's worked stupendously. And that's also how we can factor in trade shows. So it's like, okay, we know a trade show is 2 months away. We have these capacities. These in stocks are now the feature of the business that's going to be directed towards the shows. mm-hmm. or directed towards, we got a holiday coming up. It's whatever it is. And so it's like, instead of competing, doing all custom work, and then a show's coming in, we got to somehow patch on this show onto this own custom
side. That would be what I'm doing right now. Right.
Like, right.
That's more my model, and it's incredibly difficult.
It is. And we found that with Blade Show just, you know, a couple months ago. It was like, it just was a nightmare to add that to a system that didn't include that. But now it's as if the show is already included. It's just, instead of putting it on the website, we put it in a box. You know what I mean? Yeah. So it's like that ability to modulate and kind of throttle. I've never had that ability before, because it's always been waiting for custom orders.
Right.
And it's just,
and not fully knowing. Yeah. Like, what's going on.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
It's like the very next day could be a record day, or it could be 3 days of rough sales. You know, I just have no idea. Like, it's just, it's hard to say.
Yeah. That, I think right now, I think all of this is incredibly tied together. So second half of the year for me is essentially moving towards that. What I've seen is like, okay, I really am finding my love for shows again, and simultaneously understanding that, like, I can't do them in the way that I have done them for years. I have to figure out a way that is more manageable, which means I have to become more consistent. Right. So the next half of this year is essentially going to be working through my processes, focusing on the Kihoku, which is like, this is a great example of modeling. Like, I'm modeling a lot of this after you, and I'm learning this from you. Why is that? Because I see the efficiency. I see, like, where it's creating space for you. Do I want to pivot my entire business to that? No. I want to learn something new. I want to add something that is more efficient than some of my other product, and be able to reach an audience that I had for years and years, which is like the fixed blade market, which I haven't been able to, like, connect with. Modeling is really, really good. It's okay to, like, look outside of what you're doing. Mm-hmm. Right? Don't have all the answers. And, like, more than that, like, as we get older and, like, we're getting more set in our ways, like, the ability to, like, look around and be like, oh, this show is doing something really cool. I'm a show promoter. I do my shows this way. I've done my show this way for 30 years. What are they doing, and why are people going there? That's really interesting. Right. That process, I think, even in a small sense, like, I think is starting to affect, I'm seeing it affect the business. And that's, like, really nice. Like, I have a few things that are more efficient than they've ever been. And I see the peace that it creates for me. Mm-hmm. Because there is a point where, like, you don't, like, with custom work, a lot of times you have to solve the problem every time. Even if it's, like, low, like, if it's fairly low impact for you, because you have, like, the system where they can go in, they can order your setup to make the parts, you're still having to deal with that information.
Mm-hmm.
That information scaled is more and more and more and more information. The ability to add in 10%, 20%, whatever it is, of, I make the product, I post the product, or I make the product goes to a show, right? I think that is incredibly valuable.
Yeah.
And it frees up your brain. Like, the hardest part, I think, for me over the last few months has really been how much I had to focus just on the show while my brain is also wanting to do other things. And I just not having the physical time to do those.
Mm-hmm.
And that is where I'm like, okay, if you have efficiency, you can allow yourself growth, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you're digging a ditch, you're digging a ditch. You might be thinking a lot. You're not doing, like, other things. You're just, like, digging.
Mm-hmm.
You're not getting other jobs for the next ditch. I don't know where this analogy came from, but, like, you're not hustling work. You're not, like, planning whatever the next ditch looks like. Like, you're just digging. I think you have to have, or it benefits you to have some products or revenue that allows you to, like, have your time in a different way.
Yeah. Yeah. Right? That's for sure. Yeah. It's, and I, just kind of realized it just talking on the pod now about like talking about steering that came up and thinking about steering. You know what I mean? It's like make a boat that's easy to steer and just in general, that's just that allows you to look away and then come back and make it quick adjustments. You know what I mean? That allows just crispness of decision making and then results that follow.
Yeah.
And man, there's a lot of business models that aren't steerable. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. It is. It's like, and you just like send it and that's, it's like, okay, you know, Jesus, take the wheel.
Yeah.
Kind of vibe.
Yeah.
And realizing like with scale, like there's obviously like, as you get bigger, you get a certain type of resource and then you also get certain limitations. Like there's only so much steerability. I've always liked the idea. Like when I think about like growth, where it's like as small as possible, as big as necessary. I think that any business can probably look at that and kind of be like, all right, where are our strengths? Like the class you did, like process of product class, like a big business can run that filter. Right. And it's like, what is it? A lot of times a big business has more resources, financial resources. So in a certain way, you're able to use that to your advantage, where like a smaller business might not have that access. Right. If you're on the smallest side, you have like adaptability and flexibility. Right. Like even for me, like when I was just making fixed blades, I would change models. A model would have 5 or 6 iterations in between runs a lot of times, because it was so easy for me to be like, oh, take my template. I want a little more like swell in the handle, and I'd change it. As you scale, those things become more difficult. That becomes now understanding how to design a robust model in CAD, right? Because you know that you want to be able to make the changes. The same thing's true of the money, of the time. Like, it's really interesting, man. I'm curious to see how the next couple years go inside of the industry.
Yeah.
I think there are some areas that may experience some like heavier slowdowns, but who knows?
Yeah. No, it's going to be interesting to watch, but at the same time, putting it on balance with believing in what you're doing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Cause it's like, I've shared that before, but it's like emphasizing what's happening around you too much is super problematic, because there's always evidence that you're doing the wrong thing. If you want if you want to think that you're doing it wrong, you can find a reason to believe that.
Yeah. You can verify.
Every negative idea is verifiable.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Which is problematic.
It really is.
Yeah.
I like to focus on the things that are working. As opposed to things that are not working. Not always the easiest to do, but I think that for me, there's more value in kind of leaning into things that are working. I also, you know, you always hear the saying that like, you can't be in a growth state 100% of the time. So like, what is the opposite of growth would be like kind of like a stasis, right? Or like coasting. I think that there is like more to it than that. I think that like an adaptive stage, I think, is probably pretty relevant, where you're like, I'm not really growing, right? But I'm also not still. I'm just adapting to like the situation and what is occurring presently. Maybe that leads to growth. Maybe that leads to, you know, coasting. But I think it's an active process, not a passive process. And so, yeah, I want to kind of like think on that a little bit more. Cause that's to me right now, I think what I'm seeing in the industry is not necessarily 100% active or passive, but it's somehow that feels closer, where it's like the companies that are being active and adapting are doing well. The companies that are busy but like not adapting, I think that's where maybe some of the problem lies.
Yeah. Yeah.
Does that feel?
Yeah. No, it's right? That's right.
Because you can be busy, but like sliding back or like not gaining ground.
You're shoveling coal, but you're not steering. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Steer the ship.
Steer. Yeah.
Should we just call it on that? I feel like saying steer the ship and then like dropping it is awesome.
Yeah. Get yourself the biggest rudder, you know, on the ocean and use that thing. Yeah. Dude,
maybe we could just do like a whole episode of just analogies.
Yeah, dude, that's all I do, honestly. Sometimes I'm like, man, I make too many analogies, too many metaphors.
You and your dad, I feel like you and your dad could probably just put out a pretty sweet book.
Yeah.
Like
metaphors.
Yeah, dude. It'd be pretty fun.
Yeah.
Guys, thank you for sticking with us through this crazy summertime. And thank you to everyone who is supporting on Patreon. We really appreciate you. If you want to support the pod, leave us a review or share it. And hopefully this year we're going to we're kind of like getting back on track. It feels like
That's
closing in on the end of summer, not to like be a downer, but it's been 110 degrees where you are. So I'm sure you don't mind the idea of fall.
Sounds pretty good to me. We got fires popping off too. So.
Oh, I was going to ask, just side note, there's one in Burns, which is kind of like not midway between us, but it's huge.
Yeah. Yeah. The fires in central eastern Oregon are wild right now.
So, but that's
hundreds
not
of thousands of acres
close to you. Like you're not like where they say like eastern Oregon, you're not, it's not pushing close to you at all.
It's close ish in that we're buried in smoke.
Yeah. Same.
But I mean, I do know one person who was evacuated from,
close.
What's the town? Henderson.
Henderson.
No.
Yeah.
Is that what it is? Anyway, no, it's not Henderson.
It's
I forget.
Not. I know.
Starts with
I
an
know
H.
It. Yeah.
Yeah. He was evacuated, but I mean, he lives out in Oregon. I don't see him on a day-to-day basis, but yeah, so it's pretty sticky because the wind keeps blowing and the heat keeps coming. And Idaho had like 5 or 6 or 7 fires start 2 days ago. So
ugh, gnarly fire season. All right.
Yeah.
You guys didn't need to hear that probably, but if you are at risk of fire, stay safe. And we'll see you guys
to our
next
European
week.
Friends.
Yeah.
And enjoy the beautiful rain that you're probably seeing right now.
Yeah. All right. All right. Be well, guys.
Yeah. Peace.